Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, someone we haven't spoken with for a while, but I think what he has to say is very timely. We're going to speak with Mr. J.D. Tuchile. He's a former managing editor of Reason.com and current contributing editor. Having started his online career in the days of proprietary online services and seen them swept away by the internet, he's a believer in liberating and transformative power of new media. He's worked for ZDNet, the New York Daily News, and Forgotten.coms and .orgs for years. He's edited the late lamented Freedom News Daily for the equally mourned FreeMarket.net. His provocative and often witty columns on topics including civil liberties and government overreach have appeared in publications including the Arizona Republic, the Denver Post, and Washington Times. As a result, he's been quoted and criticized in the pages of such publications as the New York Times and Salon. He's also the author of the comic adventure novel High Desert Barbecue, which reviewers have kindly described as fun, a very polished novel, and filled with likable characters, tons of humor, and nice sprinkling of libertarianism throughout. He's an enthusiastic explorer of the American Southwest deserts, mountains, and forests, and he lives in rural Arizona with his wife and their son and their two dogs. So, Mr. Tuchile, I wanted to thank you so much for joining me again today, because we had a conversation offline, and I think convenience seems to be the buzzword. If it's new and it's going to make your life easier, you don't even have to think, it's just going to think for you, then it's a good thing. And I really think that's a cautionary statement with, if it's new and newfangled, you should just jump in with both feet. I wanted to pick your brain and speak about what you think are some of the things that people need to be wary of. Just because it's new doesn't make it good, does it?
No. I mean, we want things to be easier, to be convenient for us. I have an 18-year-old son, and I point out to him that when I had to research a paper back in the day, I had to go to a physical place, a library. I had to go through the card catalog and then pull old magazines and journals and books out of the stacks. He just does searches on the internet. That convenience is great, but there are trade-offs in everything that we do. Sometimes those trade-offs are worthwhile. I have a cardiac pacemaker. It speaks to a base station. It creeps me out. But I've had my cardiologist call me and say, you know what, your pacemaker is telling us stuff that is a little disturbing. We've got to address that. And then I ended up having a procedure that made my health better. But sometimes the trade-offs are not worthwhile. We use social media. We use our smartphones. We give away sometimes way too much information about our lives. We give away our location. And we do it in return for quick pleasure, a little convenience in minor matters. We trade away a huge amount of our life in return for things that may not actually be worth that trade. And it's something about which we need to be much more careful than most of us have been.
I think you're right. I mean, the smartphone, and I remember when I was in college even, having to go to the library and do index cards for my citations and make sure they were in the body of the work that I was doing. I don't think people even do that anymore. But the phones, I mean, we're just living this life where it's all about convenience. And in order to download the app, you have to give up your data. And I'm going to give you an example. I have a Polar monitor for a heart monitor. I haven't used it for years. I decided to pick it up and try to use it again. And it changed their access information. I had to give serious data about myself in order to even turn on the Polar monitor. And I said, I don't need this anymore, because forget that. I mean, it was very personal stuff, and it was going to go into a database and you couldn't opt out. And that's the difference. Haven't you noticed that before you could opt out of things and you could still download them? Is that a creeping, intrusion in our privacy?
It is. And I think it was based upon changes in public perception. In the past, if you'd ask somebody, if you said, here's a cool toy, because that's what a lot of these apps are. But in return, we want to know your name, your address, your phone number, your email address. 20 years ago, people would have said, I don't think so. But in recent years, we've gotten so accustomed to it that the option to say no has been removed from a lot of these apps, or just, you know, it's been hidden. Because it's simply assumed that we're going to say yes. And people get accustomed to saying, well, why wouldn't I drop that information in there? Mm-hmm. But there are reasons to not give that information up. You end up, some of the stuff is just annoying. You end up, of course, on mailing lists, getting texts, getting emails, getting contacts, phone calls, just marketing stuff that may or may not be of interest to you. And I hang up on probably 2/3 of the phone calls I get. And that's annoying. But it can be a little more insidious than that. It can be tracked. We know that federal agencies, for instance, buy data that's compiled by marketing firms on people's movements. Why is that? Because the apps on your phone have access to the GPS information on your phone. They also touch base when you pass the phone connections, you know, the various nodes that a phone has to connect to, and they give rough and sometimes even detailed information about your movements, where you go, which businesses you pull into, and federal agencies can actually use that to track you and see if you've been in the vicinity of a crime that they're investigating. That can be a little bit disturbing. It can also be available, for instance, to a private investigator that's looking after you. So these things can have huge implications for our privacy, for the security of our personal information, because our data can be stolen then from these app companies. How secure are they all? Well, some are probably very good and some are probably very bad. But if you give them all your information, any one of them that gets hacked, now it's out there in the wild. So there are big trade-offs involved in this, and it's because of our public perceptions. We've become more accustomed to simply saying yes, handing over data, and not really thinking about where it ends up.
I think you made a really excellent statement. There's been hacking pretty much nonstop. I think the most recent one was car dealerships, right? And before that was insurance, medical insurance companies. It's like they're going through every single sector of our society, and there seems to be some cyber attack, which makes you think this can't possibly be secure when this many things, this many, you know, different aspects of our society that are online have been hacked. So who's hacking? Do you know? I mean, is it a foreign government? Is it, I mean, I know you can answer this or not. Is it professional hacking syndicates? I mean, who's using this data, do you think?
Well, it's anybody from criminals who want to get access to our financial data so that they can scam it. We opened up a credit card invoice once and found that somebody had tried to charge a ski vacation to our credit card. It had been hacked online. We had to change the number of that credit card. In other cases, we know that the IRS, for instance, has been hacked by Chinese-related hackers. That's almost certainly state-related. So that would be an official act by one government against another. But American individuals are caught in the middle with our IRS data, which obviously is very sensitive, accessed by state actors. So between criminals, between the curious, and between state actors trying to do damage to each other's political and financial systems, we're all caught in the middle. And we all can suffer personal harm ourselves when our social security numbers, our credit card numbers, our personal information gets out into the wild. That would allow anybody to spoof us, to steal our identities, and to hijack our finances and charge things to us. So, it's a little bit of everybody out there. It's kind of a wild west, and we're all at risk no matter who is doing the hacking.
That's kind of, frightening and, disconcerting, since everything seems to be going digital. So if we talk about, you're talking about apps and things that are your taxes, etc. What about digital money then? If we go cashless, and we're about to go, I hope not, but if they do bring on board this Bitcoin and other digital money, potentially that can be hacked too, it sounds like.
Well, it depends on the digital money, and this is where there's a wide variation. Bitcoin is actually pretty secure. It's not as anonymous as a lot of people like to think, but it takes effort to track it. It can't be spoofed. It can't be stolen the way a credit card number can be stolen. But that distinguishes it, say, from a central bank digital currency, which some countries, the governments are already issuing. Those may be less secure. It really depends on how it's implemented by any given central bank. So Bitcoin was implemented pretty well. It's a kind of a discrete unit. It's well named. It's a coin. Either you have it or somebody else has it. It can't really be taken away unless someone hacks into your account. But to do that, they really need to get hold of your password or your seed. And I'm not going to go down the digital rabbit hole here on how Bitcoin works. But Bitcoin is actually pretty secure, and some of its emulators are even more so. Central bank digital currencies, though, are kind of deliberately not. Some governments want the ability to claw back money. They want the ability to limit how their currency is used. They might want to impose negative interest rates so that when your money's sitting in a bank account, instead of being paid interest, you're actually losing a little bit over time. So CBDCs, that implementation of a digital currency could be very insecure. Whether or not it's vulnerable to hackers per se, it doesn't give you a lot of safety. So it really depends upon what we're talking about. We talk about digital currency. But yeah, the digital world is kind of fraught. There's a lot of dangers out there. And you have to consider it whenever you do anything. What is it you're doing? Does it make sense? And is it worth whatever risks you might be taking on?
When you read the agreements, you know, when you're supposed to sign it, you agree. Those things are pages and pages long. And, you know, lawyers speak, I think people just go to the bottom, scroll, and then just say, I agree, without much thought until something happens. And what is the recourse then? I know if you get hacked with your credit card, the banks usually give you back your money while they're doing their investigation. But what happens when will that continue? Because I can see this becoming a much more problematic issue. If everybody's a Wild West, as you described, and hacking's going on 24/7, do you foresee at some point that they might say, oh, well, you know, that we're not going to reimburse you the money because it's a money, you know, we're losing money in the process?
Actually, I think that legally it's tightening up, at least when it comes to the private sector. Hacking has been such a problem. Badly implemented data security has been such a huge problem. I mean, a lot of these companies that get hacked, get data stolen, that's our data, have really not done a good job of securing that data. And that is something that people are becoming more aware of. The courts are becoming savvier about. And so liability is adhering to how companies implement their data security more so than in the past. Expectations are higher because once people have been hacked, once companies have been hacked, other companies can be expected to know that happened and to plan for it. And if they don't, that means they didn't heed warnings, and they can be and should be, of course, liable for what they do with their data. If they didn't secure it, if they insisted on having it, then yeah, they're the ones who really ought to be at risk of compensating us. Now, that doesn't relieve us of the hassle, the huge hassle, the expense, the dangers involved. If somebody steals your identity, just grips hold of your credit card number. But my guess is that, not just a guess, but watching what's been developing in the field of data security, is that companies are being held more liable for how they deal with our data. Unfortunately, the hackers are getting more sophisticated too, so it's an escalating war. On the other hand, that kind of liability really doesn't adhere to the IRS, to the Department of Motor Vehicles, to any other federal agency that insists on our information, and that it almost inevitably holds it in a computer system that would be laughable to anybody in the private sector. It's there to be looted. And then if you try to do something about it, the government's going to throw its hands up and say, well, you know, we're the government. We'll give you maybe a few dimes on the dollar, but that's about as far as we're going to go. And so there's a big disconnect there. And I really am not happy to have my financial information in the hands of the tax collectors.
No. Not at all from what you just described. Let's take our first break and come back because I want to delve into we talked about apps, but there's so many electrical gadgets in cars now. And I think people need to be aware of that as well. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. J.D. Tuchile, and before the break, we were getting a real primer on being mindful of what we're doing when we give information for convenience. We talked about apps and the phone and various industries that are being hacked, but there's been a big growth in cars and the conveniences, Wi-Fi, the computerized cars, you know, the computer engine and all these sort of things. I wanted to talk about that because you're driving your car, you're talking, you're doing whatever you're doing, but is that still private when you have like a Tesla or something that you actually have a computer? You're basically driving around in a big computer. Is that safe?
You know, if you're driving my old 1977 Jeep Wagoneer, your privacy is safe. But if you're driving a modern vehicle, it's absolutely not. Modern cars have been described as smartphones on wheels. And that's a very apt description. Teslas, electric vehicles in particular, are computerized. They're connected to the network. They have essentially smartphones built into them. And because an electric vehicle is basically a computer, there's not a lot you can do about that. You either opt into it, you buy that package, or you avoid that kind of a vehicle entirely. We still have some options with internal combustion engine vehicles, even though they're heavily technological, even though a lot of them are wired. To use an example, I recently purchased a 2022 Toyota 4Runner. Toyota I like their cars, but as Mozilla Foundation warned last year in a big report on the auto industry and how it's a privacy nightmare, these car companies have terrible, terrible privacy policies across the board in terms of what they'll do with the data they collect on your vehicle. And Toyota's is among the worst. So, and I think it's Nissan, actually, if you read, and nobody does this, but of course, the people from the Mozilla Foundation did. If you actually read through the disclaimers, they claim the right to monitor and record sexual activity that occurs in the vehicles they've sold. That's a little jarring. Whether or not they're actually doing that or simply giving themselves an opening to do that in the future, either way, it means that, wow, these cars are capable of doing some pretty creepy things, and they really are. Modern vehicles include cameras, they include microphones, they include GPS, and they track our movements. The majority of car companies in their privacy policies explicitly state that on request from any government agency, they will turn over the data collected from any one of the vehicles they have sold that is connected to their database. And most vehicles, most modern vehicles, are constantly sharing data through the built-in cell phone connections that are in those cars. They track your use of your brakes, how often you do that. They track your steering. They track how you accelerate and decelerate. They track your speed, of course. And they do all of these things and then share them with the mothership, the car company. In many cases, the car company then passes it along to data compilers like LexisNexis, who sell it to insurance companies. And so the New York Times reported, about 2 months ago, that people are getting surprise hikes in their insurance bills. And when they investigate, they find out that unbeknownst to them, their car has been sending data on their driving habits to their car manufacturer, which sold it to their insurance company. Insurance company doesn't like how they drive and decides they're a higher risk than was originally assumed and has now made it more expensive for them to get insurance. I mean, this is what our cars are doing. So private, is there privacy left? If you have a modern car that is connected to the grid, to the car company, unless you take some specific steps to preserve your privacy, you're basically walking around with a smartphone that doesn't even have the protections that adhere to a smartphone, broadcasting your data and your location on a constant basis.
Are you able to turn it off? Are you able to disable it?
In most cases, at least some cases, you can. Different companies have different policies. In the case of my Toyota 4Runner, there was a button inside that allowed me to connect to Toyota and request assistance, talk to an operator, what have you. I hit that and I invoked their privacy policy and I opted out of data sharing. They sent me an email confirming my opting out of data sharing and telling me which services would not be available. Things like tracking my car if it's stolen, disabling it on the road, providing roadside assistance, that sort of thing. But that's what I wanted. So I asked them to, I opted out and I asked them to discontinue and they said they would. Now, there's a leap of faith involved there, of course. I asked Toyota to stop and they promised me they'd stop. Are they actually stopping? Probably. Am I really paranoid sometimes? Yes, I am. So what I went ahead and did in addition to that is I went into the fuse box My car has two fuse boxes, and I had looked up where the data communication module, which is the built-in cell phone, is wired through, and I pulled the fuse that powers the data communication module. In the process, I also lost the internal microphone, which means that pairing my phone to the car isn't an option because I could no longer have a conversation that way. But given that smartphones are also kind of tracking beacons on their own, I don't want to do that. I don't do that. So I didn't mind losing that microphone so long as I could disable the data communication module, which means that my car no longer shares data with Toyota. It's no longer physically capable of sharing data. It is now in, you know, off the grid, and that's what I was looking for. Other vehicles, by and large, you can do that with too. However, there's no standard to it, and you have to see how you would do that given the make and model of your car. And you would also have to decide what else you might be losing, because you might, you know, maybe the microphone is also, as in my car, wired through that same fuse. Maybe one of your stereo speakers is. Maybe something else is. So you have to do some due diligence before you start before you go yanking fuses in your vehicle. And I'm sure my warranty no longer applies. But it is something to consider, because this matters to me. I don't think the trade-off of the conveniences that adhere to being connected to the grid through my car are worth the loss of privacy and anonymity. So I went ahead and did that. And others can do the same if that's important to them too.
Well, what strikes me about this, you know, big brother type of situation, it's always negative. So you haven't had a car accident, right? You haven't run afoul of the law. You haven't run traffic lights. You've driven too far. You've used your accelerator too much. You know, it's just what they can do to jack the price up and to put you on a negative footing. It's like a pre-crime almost, right? So they're going to charge you more money for you using your vehicle, which you purchased, to do whatever you want with, as long as it's legal. That seems to me to be very, cynical. And it allows them to have a lot more leverage than they should. Has anybody in your... to your knowledge, taking them to court to say, you need to jack the price up if I have a car accident. That's reasonable. But if I drove a certain distance or a certain speed, that doesn't seem reasonable. Is anybody fighting that?
I think there is some litigation starting out now, but this is relatively new. That New York Times article was kind of a revelation. And the thing is, a lot of these, like OnStar, a lot of the connected insurance companies, because many people's car insurance companies will offer them an app and say your rate will be lower. So a lot of this connection is sold as a means of saving money. The fact of the matter is, though, if somebody is offering an app, if they're asking for more data, they're not looking for a way to make less money from you. I think we all have to be clear on that point. These insurance apps may be sold to us as a means of us saving money and lowering our insurance rates, but the only reason they're available is because the insurance companies are betting that across the board, when you average drivers, they're going to actually end up charging more and making more money. That's the only reason they would have invested in the technology behind these apps and in the effort involved in distributing them. So if anybody's offering something to you, unless it's your favorite uncle, chances are it's not a means of making life less expensive and more hassle-free for you. Chances are it's a means of benefiting them. And I think we have to be realistic about this. I don't think that's cynical. I think that's realism. And I think more of us need to be rather more realistic than we have been when we take advantage of these conveniences that are presented to us as means of making our lives easier and cheaper.
It just seems it's one more log on this pile of control, right? It's you're controlling yourself when you adapt that. I'm going to drive so I can get a lower rate. That means you're actually kowtowing to what, I don't know, I think the insurance companies have, I believe you, they're all about making money, but it's also about behavior and controlling behavior. And if you can control yourself, that takes the onus off of everything else in society, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, insurance companies, when they hike these rates, it's because they've been looking at acceleration, deceleration, and we're expected to modify our behavior accordingly. And the fact is, even if at the end of the day, I was going to save money, I don't want to be driving around or doing anything in my life with the idea that somebody is looking over my shoulder and judging my conduct. I don't like that. I don't honestly want my wife doing that. I certainly don't want the insurance company doing that. So yes, there's a huge loss of control here. There's loss of privacy here. There's also loss of control over our cars. I mean, one of the anti-crime features built into vehicles is the ability for the manufacturer, if you inform them your car has been stolen, to simply disable your car immediately. They can hit an off switch and the car goes off. People who have rented cars and wandered outside of a geographic zone that the rental company thought they were going to remain inside have discovered that the car was disabled for the same reason. There's a loss of control there. I don't want someone remotely being able to disable my car, even if it's supposed to be more secure for me, if they could do that, because they would never do it for malign reasons. You know what? I'll take the risk. I would rather have full control over whether or not my car starts when I go out and hit the key or the fob in the morning. That's something I want for me. So yes, there's a loss of control in all of this technology that's exchanged for convenience that a lot of people like. I mean, I've talked to people and I explained the situation. A lot of them say, "But yeah, but I really need to pair my phone to my car so I can do the following things." And I'm like, okay. If you make that conscious decision, that's on you, but we should be able to opt out.
Agreed. And everybody needs to be treated like an adult, right? And you have to make decisions and it's up to you to do your own due diligence and research. I think we're being we're being made to be children. We can't live our own lives because we're going to muck it up. That's basically what we're being told. But in actuality, when we're individuals, it makes it less convenient for us to be, you know, herded and pushed in directions that whoever powers that be want us to go in. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. J.D. Chuchile, and you can read what he writes. He's an author. He's also a contributing editor at Reason.com. And you should check out his work because it's thought-provoking. It's makes you really think outside the box. And I think that's what the show is really trying to put out there. Just because it's easy doesn't mean it's good for you. And you really have to be an adult and decide the pros and cons, what could happen, what could go wrong. I don't think people think of that anymore. They just seem to just want to have, you know, I don't know. It's just not thought out. If it's there, then it's a good thing and I should just partake of it. Forget about all the possibilities of how it affects me down the road or society for that matter. So if we're talking about the cars being able to shut your car off, does that also extend to the police and to, you know, you being, I guess, guilty until proven innocent. If something does go on, they can pull your vehicle records. They can do all these things and use them as evidence against you, I would think, can't they?
They absolutely can. And actually, this is an area where cars are even worse than smartphones. The reason federal agencies buy data about smartphones from marketing firms is because if they go to you and say, "Give me your smartphone," they need a warrant. However, cars are not protected the same way. And in fact, many of the cars that we have now that we pair our phones with immediately download data from our phones and then back it up in the car's internal computer system, your contacts, your messages, all sorts of things. So when it's on your phone, that data requires a warrant for the police to see it. If it's in your car's computer, it no longer requires a warrant. The cops can go to the car manufacturer and say, "Hey, could you turn this over?" And a majority of the car companies explicitly say they'll just do it on request. They will turn it over. It actually looks like it's going to get worse, too. Built into requirements for cars starting in about 2 years. I forget the exact timeline, but it's not far in the future. New vehicles are supposed to have alcohol detection systems built into them so that when you get in a car, and there's a couple of competing technologies as to how they'll do this, they're supposed to detect whether the driver has consumed alcohol. And if they do, they're going to disable themselves automatically. So talk about guilty until presumed innocent. Did you think that one glass of wine was not excessive? Well, you're going to be second-guessed by your own car. And then it may not start. It may actually phone the police and let them know that there's potentially intoxicated driver behind the wheel. And this is by law. That's actually going to happen. It's already been mandated by the federal government.
This has already passed.
It has already passed. And that's already a requirement for cars starting in about 2 years. The technology is not yet ready for prime time, so they may have to bump that back, but the law already exists.
So what about the Fourth Amendment? You know, search and seizure, legal search and seizure, what happens with that? Doesn't it run afoul of that?
I would think. The thing is, though, when you mandate that a private company do something as an end run, because the cops can't preemptively walk up to everybody heading toward a parking lot and say, all right, everyone's got to breathe into the breathalyzer. They're not allowed to do that. But if they mandate the cars essentially build something like a breathalyzer into each and every vehicle and test the driver every time the driver gets into the vehicle, well, I would think that still invokes constitutional concerns. But I believe that's probably going to have to be tested in court. And I would not guarantee which way that's going to go, because we're in the outer limits here. Governments are getting used to deputizing private firms. We saw this with the government leaning on social media companies to suppress dissenting views during COVID. Governments are getting accustomed to deputizing private firms to do end runs around limitations on government power and to do end runs around due process. And that is exactly what building a alcohol detection system into each and every car sounds like to me.
That's the ultimate in cynicism then, isn't it? You know you can't get it by the book. So you make an end run and you use corporate America to get the job done. I mean, this is, to me, it's an extension of what happened in the healthcare system, you know, with tracking people and being able to have them have some sort of ID that either makes them part of society or denies them. This could really be chilling, have a chilling effect on those who want to live in a free manner and to be individuals. This is a way to really corral them. I thought that things like universal basic income and digital dollars would do it, but this is can potentially get a lot more people under the thumb, couldn't it?
Oh, it absolutely can. I mean, and there's precedent for it too. In the 70s, for a brief period of time, about a year, there was a mandate by the federal government for seatbelt interlocks. Cars would not start unless you put on your seatbelt, clicked them tight, and clicked them shut. And this caused some problems. There were people who got in the car, put their groceries on the passenger seat, and the car wouldn't start because the car, you know, picked up a weight in the passenger seat and determined that somebody hadn't put on their seatbelt. People were trying to get anywhere in a hurry, were trying to go someplace. I believe there were a couple of crimes people were trying to get away from, and they were held up. The car wouldn't start until the seatbelt was clicked. So, I mean, that was ridiculous, and it was repealed because it had bad results. I actually remember my father buying a car at that time and then getting hints from the dealer on how to disconnect that interlock. And I fully expect that's going to happen, going forward with things like the alcohol detector. It's already happening now. People are going in and hacking their cars using a home onboard diagnostics test. You know, you can plug one in and use an app on your phone to kind of rewire the computer in your car and disable some of the functions. But this is going to be a running battle, and governments have tried it before, as with that seatbelt interlock, and the temptation there. As technology gets more sophisticated, because people who go into government, I think, you know, statement of opinion, of course, tend to be control freaks. I mean, who else wants to go into an institution that exists to exert power over other people's lives? Well, they're always going to look for an easy way to do that. And as the technology extends their reach, they're going to try to take advantage of it unless we push back.
It's like a carrot and the stick, right? You get it with a little bit of sugar. It's awesome. You're going to be socially superior because you have this vehicle or these technological advances that you're partaking of. But then when people, I guess they get the people who are easy to get in, and then it becomes more mercenary, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, again, as we get accustomed to it, as we more interventions in our lives, kind of accumulate, and we just consider them part of the background noise, it's easy to move the goalpost and just make it more and more restrictive. So instead of having a car that's off the grid or a phone that just makes phone calls, you've got something that offers what are sold as conveniences and were intended as conveniences, originally at least, but which extends intrusions into our lives, makes us trackable. Why? Well, the government always has law enforcement concerns. They'll never stop it. And if you listen to the government, they could justify anything based on fighting crime or terrorism or cars. I mean, cars are big and dangerous. Of course, the government wants to make them safer, in quotes, so they'll justify everything based upon safety, limitations on how fast you can go, building in governors on speed, building in alcohol detectors, building in the ability to shut off a car at a distance. These things can all be justified based upon the mindset of regulators who are inclined to more control at all times. And of course, the people who are marketing these things aren't inclined that way. You talk about marketing companies, people make the apps, but they make money on the information we give them, and they make money on the constant data connections, which have to be paid for, and they make money on selling us privileges and allowances. And between the convergence of technology, the desire to make a profit by selling this technology, and the desire to control the behalf on the part of regulators, we find ourselves ever more hemmed in by the world in which we live.
Now, what's our recourse? Could we just give bogus information? People tend to be a lot more, tell the truth when they probably don't have to, be completely honest about their age or, their sex or anything like that. Would changing some of the data, innocuous pretty much, would that put a wrench in the system?
It can. I mean, I've certainly put in bogus email addresses and bogus phone numbers into certain apps. Some of them get savvier about that. They test it and kick it back if it doesn't test out as real data. But yeah, the more junk data you can put in the system, and sometimes, I mean, to get away from the examples we're using, I mean, something like the loyalty cards we use at the supermarket. I mean, honestly, if you hand your loyalty card to the person behind you and swap with them, you both get the same discount. But all of a sudden, instead of being someone who likes a particular brand of bourbon, you're somebody who likes to buy a lot of cat food. And that's junk data going into the system. And it makes the data that they're collecting less reliable, less usable, less marketable. Doing that sort of thing on a regular basis takes a little bit of dedication, of course. But it's not a bad idea when you can to enter junk data if you really want that convenience. But the real, and the next step I would say is, do you really need some of these things? Are the trade-offs worthwhile? Do you want to put those apps on your phone? Are you really sure? Do you want to be on social media? Do you want your car connected at all times? I mean, why can't you just use Google Maps or even a paper map instead of having your car, constantly running GPS and tracking your movements? And of course, that's a judgment each of us individually ought to be able to make on our own. And in the end, of course, I mean, we have to make that determination as individuals. This isn't something that can be decided on a holistic level.
Well, I think that's a much better way to do it. I think there's too much groupthink as it stands. So if we're able to, really tease out if this is good for us, not because we're part of a whole or a group, or they just divide and conquer constantly and parse us into little, individual, I should say, group. The groups are getting smaller, basically. It's not so much your sex or your race or anything else. It's just getting really, really, just cut up in different aspects so that we can always find a way not to get along. So I know we're going to take a break in a minute, and I want to start when we come back, the conversation, and we started it about what we need to do. But what happens if we've already given our data? Can we ever get it back? And I'll let you answer that after the break. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. J.D. Trucile. And before the break, I started a question that I'm sure people who are listening to the show must have themselves. I've given my data. I put these apps on my phone. I've partaken in this system. Can I pull it back? Can I just, if I erase the app, will my data go away? I guess people ask that question. I'll ask that question first. Is that something that people can think about? Or once you've done it, it's no pulling back?
To be perfectly honest, once your data is out there in the wild, it's out there in the wild and you're not getting it back. Now, some of that information, of course, ages out. If you move, the old address becomes obsolete. The same with phone numbers. If you cancel a credit card, the fact that somebody got hold of it, you know, from a database that was hacked 5 years ago isn't going to do them any good. Other things are just permanent. Your name, your social security number is very hard to change. Some of this data, you cannot erase it once it's out there. There's just nothing you could do about that. So I would say is, I mean, be very diligent about what trade-offs you're willing to make. Don't be afraid to say, no, I'm not willing to do that. I'm not willing to give this information over. And give up certain conveniences. Also, you know, like I did, I mean, if you have to disconnect, you know, maybe use a less smartphone, maybe don't use social media. But in the end of the day, if you've made the decision to give information over and to release it into the wild, it's not coming back.
Well, is there some power in the next generation? The children, I don't think they don't know what good it is. And they've been giving information from the time they can put themselves on the internet. Is there value in parents really starting the process early of teaching their children not to give their data up?
Yes. My son is actually much savvier than I am in some of these ways. He doesn't do social media. And if you ask him why, he'll cite chapter and verse all the bad things that happen to your information, and as well as the sociological effects, which is a discussion for another day. He and his peers know that once you go online and start releasing information about yourself, the profile starts building. And there's nothing you can do about that. So he's much more reticent about using a lot of online than I am. And that's a good thing. And I think we all should do that. Don't give smartphones to a 12-year-old. There's no particular reason for them to have it. If you have to give a phone to them, make it limited so that they're not downloading social media apps. There are plenty of dumb phones out there that just make phone calls and send a basic text. And also educate them. You let them know there are real dangers to this. And that, and I'll keep using this word, it all involves trade-offs and all those fun things you think you're going to do. That free gaming site, that social media, there's a reason it's free. It's because not collecting your money, they're collecting something else from you that they can then turn into money. That's how they pay their bills. They're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. So yeah, the next generation can be raised to be a little savvier and a little more skeptical than we were. We kind of embrace the online world because it does a lot of good. I mean, I make my living on it. But there are also dangers there that we have to be savvier about. And it's not just the internet, of course. It's also the connected tech, the phones, the cars, all those electronic devices that seem so cool. I see no reason why my dryer has to be hooked up to the internet, and yet it has that capability. Just say no to that. We all should.
Oh, I agree. And you just brought up a new category, which would be the smart appliances, right? Things that are on the internet. You can turn your crock pot on when you're not at home. Do you really need that? I mean, ultimately, everything is in this system, on this grid, that they know from the time you wake up to the time, and my God, the beds, those are smart beds now too, right? So they know how deep you sleep. They can change the temperature on the bed. They listen with microphones to see if you're snoring, and then they adjust the bed. There just doesn't seem to be any safe harbor for you to just live your life and make decisions instead of something being made for you. It's kind of interesting how this just mushroomed, isn't it?
It is. The Internet of Things, where your thermostat and your dryer and your oven are all internet capable, so you can control them through an app. But if you have access through an app, then somebody is savvier than you who can break through what is often a kind of an elementary level of encryption will also have access to it. Now, most of the time, that's not going to be the case. Most of us are not on anybody's radar. But if you are, or if somebody is just messing around, or if, for instance, as happens in some states, you opt into a what you think is going to be a money savings program with your utility company because they use a smart thermostat, but then you find out that during high usage times, they're going to dial your thermostat down on their own without your say-so, because you opted into that, you lose a lot of control when you do these things. There's no reason to have everything be so high tech. There's a real argument to be made for using high tech when it's appropriate, but only when it's appropriate, and then keeping everything else a little dumb and a little more within your control.
I couldn't have said it better. And I've read stories about people getting their baby monitors hacked and, you know, being spied on and with all sorts of things. It just doesn't seem, there doesn't seem to be any recourse. I mean, I haven't heard of anybody being prosecuted or finding the individuals who are doing these things. It's just this nebulous, oh, you've been hacked, or something we can do, change your information, and oh, well. To have this level of control, to me, without having consequences when it goes wrong, seems to be very one-sided. That should give people pause just from that standard.
Oh, yes. And honestly, that's not going to change. I mean, low-level hacking is very hard to trace and to do anything about. It's only when it's high profile, when someone does a ransomware attack and then collects a lot of money, that it's worth the time and effort to even try to track them and hold them to account. And in those cases, most ransomware hackers get away with it. It's only when they go again and again and again and eventually get sloppy that the authorities are able to catch up with them. So, yes, I mean, if you're going to expose yourself, chances are there won't be any recourse. If you keep a lot of stuff in the cloud, that's sensitive information, it's vulnerable if anybody cares to go looking for it. So take fewer risks. Use less high tech. I use a lot of high tech in a lot of cases because I really do need it. I need that cardiac pacemaker that's wired to the base station. But what I don't need is a bunch of apps tracking me on my phone. What I don't need is my car constantly phoning home and telling the manufacturer and the insurance company how fast I drive and how quickly I decelerate. These are things that are just not necessities to me, to the point where I resent them and I won't permit them. And we all should make more judgments about that. There are things that are worth the trade-off. There's a lot that is not worth that kind of a trade-off. The loss of control, the loss of privacy, the loss of autonomy in our lives. And we need to take more of that back.
I mean, it's precious. Once you've given it, as you described, you can't claw it back. It's out there. And if you, God forbid, have ever been affected by it, it changes, I would think, if nothing else, your feeling that you're safe, you know, that you are an autonomous individual. And your thoughts and your purpose is no one can control that, or worse yet, put value on it. Because again, it seems like most of these things, when you take a 30,000 foot view, you're not a good person. You're a bad person. You're using too much resources. Something's wrong with you, and you need to be controlled. It's not the opposite of people being able to express themselves. It's the opposite, because somehow when people express themselves, it goes against somebody else. Like you did it to somebody else, and therefore you need to be somehow controlled and curtailed. That's what I really find as the linchpin, or I should say the foundation, for most of these control mechanisms. It's about the worst in humanity, the worst in the person, without even knowing them or their motivations. It's very much one size fits all. And I don't like that in medicine, and I certainly don't like it socially. And now we're getting into a point where we're all inadvertently giving them more power and data to make it more stringent and more powerful.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, we build vulnerabilities in. And if you're talking about the ability to, you know, you mentioned the, you know, to speak your mind, to criticize the powers that be. The more vulnerability you have, the more back doors you leave for people to retaliate against you. And it can be done in ways that aren't obvious, but they can make your life very inconvenient. So, I mean, being a little unplugged, being a little more autonomous, being a little more careful about what kind of openings would leave to the world, allows us to be free, not just in those areas, but in so many others, because it becomes harder to come at us except for straight on, where it becomes obvious that somebody wants to get back at us because we offended them. Limiting that, limiting those openings increases our autonomy and enhances our liberty. And it makes it easier just to live a life without somebody peering over our shoulders at all times, judging us, and then taking action based upon how we've been judged.
Well, when you say that, it strikes me of that social credit score, right? Is this part of that, could be part of that puzzle, that you're just another piece going into the puzzle of you can't drive, you don't have the rights to drive because what you're saying on your social media, or something that's, again, a control factor that's going to take away your quality of life, and it becomes easier to do it remotely and in subtle ways that you really, unless you're really savvy, you may not even pick up on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we this isn't China, and we keep on saying this isn't China, but it may end up being in the end that whereas China planned on having a social credit system, we may end up stumbling into one. That assembles itself from various parts that were initially put in place because they were convenient. But in creating those conveniences, we also create vulnerabilities that lend themselves to being used as kind of a social credit system. Even if it's never officially established, even if it's never evoked as a matter of policy, it just ends up working the same way.
Well, right now it's not as severe, but it's socially happened, right? You've got people who get doxxed and people who make a statement, and next thing you know, they're showing up in your workplace, they track you down, and you can become hostage to the system based on having access to your data.
Well, yes, and you especially see that in, say, payment systems. We know that PayPal can be politicized and has been politicized. GoFundMe was cut off when people were trying to send donations to the Freedom Convoy in Canada, for instance. So because these systems are high tech, they're traceable, they can be linked to how you're using your money rather than you just going ahead and using your money, they can then be cut off and weaponized. Maybe not even because the system, the payment platform, for instance, is malicious, but because it's susceptible to pressure from outside, from people who oppose it. So there are huge vulnerabilities in this kind of a system. At the same time, that there are huge conveniences. It's nice to be able to use a donation system that's digital. It's nice to be able to use PayPal. It's nice to be able to use all of these things. But because they are high tech, because they are they track our movements, they track our affiliations, they track our connections, they also increase our vulnerability. And they do, even if they don't on a consistent basis threaten our liberty, they already have threatened the liberty and limited the liberty of people in the past, and they threaten to do more so in the future.
Well, you've given us a lot of things to think about and a lot of calls to action to stop being passive about our freedom. You can't be, because there's always something that wants to grab it and use it against you. In the moments that we have left, how can people follow you, get your books, and read what you write?
Well, please check me out at Reason.com. I write for Reason magazine. If you have any Canadian listeners, they can check me out at the National Post in Canada. I write a weekly column for them too. I'm always writing. I have a newsletter that goes out from Reason on a 3-time-a-week basis. And I hope to keep readers intrigued with what's going on in our world, sometimes with good news, not just with things that we find disturbing.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.